All right, welcome back to Cairo Knights. On the line right now is Cairo Knights' newest resident gun guy, Chris Heinzelman. Chris, we have you on when the conversation around firearms gets a little bit too heated, gets a little bit too out of control, and we need a voice of reason, a voice of understanding, a voice of compassion, a strong voice. We need the voice of somebody who can cut through all the clouds and actually say, this is what's going on with gun enthusiasts. And so you and I were kind of shooting the idea back and forth of talking about how can we get people who are flat out anti-gun, anti-firearm, nobody should be allowed to have anything more than a pea shooter. How do we get those people to empathize with people who support the Second Amendment? And I thought you had a really great point out there, which is that this is not a left or right issue. This is much more about either, because there are lefties out there that love the idea of guns. I mean, Marx himself was a huge enthusiast of saying you have to have an armed population. So how do we bridge the gap with somebody who's just flat out anti-Second Amendment, who says that that should be repealed and that that's terrible?
Well, I mean, first of all, how big is the gap we have to divide?
Right.
those who say, hey, no guns, no way, no how, ever, I'm not listening to them just as much as I'm not listening to those who say, hey, any gun, anytime, no matter what, felon or not felon. Like, we've got two extremes of the spectrum, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the minorities of the each side exist on that fringe spectrum. And man, I, to be honest, I don't listen to either side that are that extreme. You know, who can we talk to in the middle that might have a possibility of changing their mind a little bit?
Right.
You know? So to those, I say, well, you know, yeah, an armed populace. Like, so, man, so I work at a gun store, right? And I can't tell you how many people came in last year, especially from Seattle, right? Never had a gun before. Don't like guns. Never thought I'd have a gun. My wife didn't let me have a gun.
Right.
But now with all this going on, right, here I am.
My wife didn't let me have. And then smash cut to my wife and she's like, don't touch my guns. So
exactly. So yeah, man, I mean, obviously plenty of left and right people care about their guns. I guess, yeah, the question is, like, how do we really make any progress addressing everybody's issues?
Yeah, and my thought is that people look at, let us say, Parkland, or they look at the shooter in El Paso, Texas, and they see specifically young men going into highly populated areas with AR-15 style weapons, and they say to themselves, in order to solve that problem of homicidal sociopathic young men, we need to eliminate the tools that they use. And my argument is always like, I just don't see how that works that way. I mean, you've heard me talk about it, I don't know how many dozens of times on nights where I say, you take away guns, that young man is going to go online and he's going to learn about pipe bombs, or he's going to learn about how to make napalm, or he's going to learn about how to make Molotov cocktails. And then instead of a Parkland where you have tragically 17 people die, you're going to have, I don't know how many dozens of people who burn to death. So the question is it's like they're trying to tackle this question of how do we deal with young men in society who do these awful crimes? Well, we need to take away the mechanisms of destruction. They're going to find another way to do it. And so my whole thought about how we get somebody to who's maybe on the fence about the Second Amendment, or they're concerned about it, or whatever it is to show them that if you were to talk about it, and if you were to approach it, and if you were to actually hold a firearm and learn about or learn from someone like you or from my buddy Wes or whatever it is, actually talk to somebody who practices safe gun firearm habits, that fear kind of goes away over time, right?
Absolutely. That's, you know, so anytime I talk to my students, I had a student over the weekend, older gal, maybe in her 60s, her and her husband were there. And she leads with, like, I'm scared of firearms.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm intimidated. Okay, cool. We're going to demystify it, right? We're afraid of things we don't understand.
Yeah.
So I think there are two camps there. There's one camp that says, I don't know anything about guns, therefore I'm afraid of them, right? It's kind of an instinctual response.
Yep.
Okay, I can get that. And the answer I say to that is like, all right, well, go to a well-regulated facility that has training and demystify that, right? Learn something about it and see how it strikes you. Then there's the other camp that says, well, yeah, those homicidal, you know, young men doing whatever, it's the tool that we need to regulate and get rid of. Like, Those people are not necessarily afraid of guns because they don't understand them. Those people see this terrible thing happening and go, wow, what's the quickest way that we can get rid of that?
Yeah.
Right. What's the quickest way that we can get rid of this kind of violence? But I think you're absolutely right. Like, okay, pipe bombs or whatever else, or rent a van.
Exactly.
How many times did we see, you know, a van or a vehicle plow into a bunch of people because they thought differently, right? Yeah. Like, they're going to do it however they're going to do it. No, so the key is to reach those people, expect better of our community and our society and our people. You know, like, why aren't we addressing the mental side of that?
Yeah, and I also, this is kind of a weird tangent, but I kind of looked into the Parkland case because that for some reason it's becoming more popular for people to talk about it again, particularly online on and people. I guess I think there was a video that was released of the shooter. The interrogation footage was released on YouTube. And so now everyone's all abuzz talking about it again. And one of the things that I find kind of weird about it is that people forget that there was a security guard at that school who neglected to do his duty. I think that many people forget that aspect of the story of that one security guard who was armed, who was there, who said, I'm not going in there. What are you guys, nuts? Why nobody focuses on that element of the story is like, I have no idea why. It's almost like if someone goes to rob a bank or something like that and they go, well, what about the security guard? And they were like, well, he was smoking Marlboros in the parking lot and he didn't want to, you know what I mean? It's like that kind of detail that people forget about, and they hang on to the shooter and the guns, but they miss the idea that there was a guy who was actually there to protect those kids who failed to do his duty and who's now facing criminal charges as a result of that. I mean, the trial is ongoing. So my whole thing is, how do we tell somebody, or how do we convince somebody who's got kids and their kids go to a public school? How do we empathize with that person about their fear around this issue and say, hey, I want armed guards at schools? Like, I'm all for some kind of partnership between public school and the police department to have cops there during all hours, right? I mean, if this is our most precious resource, what are we doing just like leaving it out into the open? So my question to you, Chris, is as somebody who's a firearms guy and someone who understands that there are people out there who are deeply afraid of the firearm, how do you think we connect with that person to say, I want to protect kids too, and I want kids to be the most protected out of everything, right?
It's not just the kids in schools, it's malls, it's shopping centers,
right?
It's movie theaters, right? So like, if we're going to look at it, let's not just look at schools and kids. Yes, that's a huge one. Yes, that's the most defenseless.
Yeah.
But it's everything, and it's so many places. As far as, you know, armed officers in schools, I'm all for it, man. I remember having cops in my schools growing up, and like, they were friendly and they were cool. And like, I started to build a good relationship and a good outlook on what officers are.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know, on that point, man, I say now we're almost hitting two birds with one stone, right? We're developing a better relationship between our community, young community who are forming their opinions, and the law, right? And officers.
Yeah.
If you learn that, you know, Officer Bob at your middle school was super friendly and nice and awesome and didn't treat you any different, hey, cool. Like, there's some progress being made there as well.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't think that some people are going to be okay with just, oh, how about an armed response? Because one, well, that Parkland security guard, he was armed. He was there.
Right.
Didn't do his job. Just because somebody's there doesn't mean they're going to do anything. But it is a bit of a deterrent, right? If there's a few of them there, or you can expect that maybe that would help a little bit. To answer the question of how do we get people to feel better about it, like, you just got to desensitize them, you know, or you can say, hey, how about we're going to ignore that just for a minute, and how about we fix the problem without your feelings of guns tied to it,
right?
Because we can do it without them, really. I mean, we can make these changes and we can have positive impacts without them. Did you read that little bit about the CVI?
Yeah, I did. And I wanted to know if you could kind of maybe elaborate on that, because it's all me reading it is basically like reading pig Latin. So could you explain that to me?
So if you check out Biden's, you know, stimulus plan or whatever that is, the infrastructure plan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Under the gun control heading, there's like millions of dollars for CVI, criminal violence interrupters, I believe it stands for.
Yeah.
And it's not gun control. It has nothing to do with taking guns away. It is nonprofit organizations in these big cities like Chicago, Oakland, New York, these places that we all kind of think of as bastions of gun control, but man, are some of the most violent, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And they work in and with the community. They recruit and they tap respected people in their communities to act as mediators, right? We want to talk about defund the police, get rid of all the guns. We should have social workers. We should have, you know, first response people that are not necessarily just gun wielding. Well, they're doing it. That's happening right now, and it's working. It's bringing stats down as far as violent crime. One example was they were having an elevated homicide rate between two particular gangs. And when they brought in one of their interrupters, they determined that it was because each side was wearing T-shirts that said RIP to some other person of the other gang. Like, basically just a big, you know, middle finger every time they saw each other.
Right, right.
And so they get this mediator to come in and say, hey, how about we just stop wearing those shirts and maybe less people are going to get shot. Right. And it worked.
Yeah.
And so like, cool. Like they squashed that. Now there's some other conflict that they can get started right up because of that type of culture, but it's working. And the problem I see with it is the left wants nothing to do with it because it's not taking guns away and it's looking at communities and certain places and saying, well, no, hold on. You can't blame them for the choices they make. It's the guns that they have. Right. So the left doesn't want to support it as much. Because it's not real gun control, and the right doesn't want to support it because it's listed under gun control on the infrastructure plan.
Yeah.
So, like, who was responsible for the marketing on that one? Because they biffed it hard, right? They biffed it.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to, and sure enough, like, okay, I can't say nobody supports it because, you know, Biden's trying to give millions of dollars, which, hey, go for it.
Right.
Doesn't touch the Second Amendment, and it stems violent crime. That's a win-win.
Just as another example, I saw a piece of footage from, I think, a couple of weeks ago. It's a guy in Texas, and he is in a line of people at a grocery store, and there's a guy there, and he's a drug addict. He's obviously clearly blown out of his mind, and he attempts to rob the clerk. There's no way he's going to rob this clerk at this Safeway, right? So this guy, this responsible gun owner, I'm sure he's got his concealed carry permit. He pulls out his firearm. He points it at the guy. The drug addict starts crying. He drops the knife. The cops show up. They don't even handcuff the guy. They just take him outside. It's this whole thing. But it made me think about this. Like, no one will ever showcase that piece of footage on the news. It will never make national news. That this responsible gun owner takes out his ACP, points it at this other guy. The other guy drops his knife, starts crying. There's no swearing in the clip. There's no violence in this clip. You will never see that on Good Morning America. You will never see that on the Today Show. It simply will not exist. It will die as a local story. But then you have a weekend of crime in Chicago, and that will be front page news. And I find that to be really troubling, that one story of literally the good guy with the gun is going to just be buried, and then this weekend of violence is going to be what everybody talks about.
Yeah, and like, you know, it's the same as any issue. It's multifaceted, you know. Call it a boat that's sinking. It's taken on water.
Yeah.
There's some small holes. There's some big holes. There's some patches. Like, Which one do you try to patch first while you're bailing out the water? What are you going to get the most results with? Yeah, the media is a big one. You know, if you're looking for it, you can find tens and dozens and probably hundreds of examples of good guys using their firearm. And even better than that, even to prevent not just, you know, somebody taking a few bucks out of a register, but saving life.
Right, right? Exactly.
Ultimately, that's what it is. It's defense. It's saving life. There was another wonderful example in Arizona. It's a little outdated, but I just read about it recently because nobody talks about it. Nobody pumps it. Gentleman in Arizona, concealed carry, driving down whatever highway. And as he's passing what appears at first to just be a regular traffic stop of cop car behind, you know, another car, as he's passing it, he looks to the side and he sees, no, actually, officer's on his back on the ground and the guy's on top of him just wailing on him. This guy pulls over, hops out, pulls out his firearm, a few verbal commands of, hey, knock it off, get off of him, stop it, right?
Yeah.
Probably trying to do anything he can before that last, you know, final alternative. And unfortunately, you know, but fortunately, depending on how you look at it, this bystander, this innocent bystander who didn't know this cop, didn't have any responsibility to put himself in harm's way, he hops out of his vehicle and he uses his defensive firearm to exactly that, to save life.
Right.
Preserve good, innocent life. Right.
Yeah.
It happens all the time. happens all the time. I'm not saying that everybody who has a gun has to do that, right? But it offers up the opportunity. If we can't get rid of mass shootings, if we can't get rid of mass violence or criminal behavior, right, overnight, which we're not going to, there's got to be an alternative in the meantime that allows people to at least protect themselves if given an option or a situation. And anything that we do, we have to be asking ourselves, are we checking both boxes for both sides? Are we doing something that will actually limit violent crime, right? Both sides can agree on that, left and right, pro-gun, anti-gun, whatever. Nobody in their right mind wants violent crime. We have that in common. And then the second box is, okay, well, are we restricting perfect, normal, law-abiding citizens' rights in the process? If right. we said, hey, we can get rid of this one terrible, really, really terrible thing, but in the process, we're going to restrict your freedom of speech, more people would be up in arms about it. Totally. Hey, we're going to do this, but we're going to take away the sovereignty of your home, right? We can just come in your house whenever we want, no warrant, no nothing, but hey, it's for a good cause. They're not going to be into it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They're not going to be into it. Because even with warrants and everything else, accidents happen, man. They get to the wrong house. So what's to say that you could be just minding your own business, living your life, and all of a sudden, boom, door kicks in. Like, it happens anyway. I'm getting off the weeds as an example, but it's the same deal, right?
Yeah.
We have to be able to satisfy both sides a little bit and not care too much about the far extremes.
Chris, in the last 30 seconds that we have, can you give everybody your details so that they know how to find you if they want to get in touch?
Yeah, I'm an instructor at West Coast Armory North. I worked in the pro shop as well, kind of pays the bills. But I'd say this, if you are anywhere near thinking about or entertaining the idea of checking out firearms for yourself and getting it from the horse's mouth and not just letting the talking heads dictate to you what they are about, take a class, private lesson, class of 8 or 12, whatever it may be. Or even just come in and ask some questions and just understand, find out for yourself. That's the best thing I could do to anybody who's hopefully middle of the road or at least closer to.
Chris Heinzelman is our resident gun expert. We will take a really quick break. We'll be right back with some Billy Sunshine after this. All right, on the line right now is the man who I saw this weekend, who I am tired of talking to and never want to see again, Mr. Billy Sunshine. Did you enjoy having me over at your house, Mr. Sunshine?
Well, yeah, because you brought your beautiful partner with you.
I did, yeah.
That helps a lot.
Billy, speaking of people traveling, I read this article over the weekend, and I wanted to talk to you about it, but not in your presence, because I hate talking to you about politics when I'm physically around you, because you start to sweat profusely and you smell terrible. But
none of that's true.
So, Billy, you know how you and I often talk about how useless politics is in so many ways, and how not government, but politics itself.
Right.
And how politics,
exactly. Right. Well said. Yeah.
So 56 House Republicans called on Biden to fire Kamala Harris from her border crisis role. And
I agree with them. I agree with them.
I see. The thing is that this is such red meat for people, and they get so excited when they read something like this. But they need to understand how useless it is for a very small cadre within the House to come out and to say, we need to remove Vice President Kamala Harris from the border crisis. It does nothing. It's like a bunch of kindergartners getting together and saying, we need to remove Mrs. Thorngate from our recess time. They literally have no power whatsoever. And it's just a
symbolic. All it does is continue the worst part of what politics are today.
Huh.
Just saying, you guys, come on, stop it. Just attacking each other any way you can. Now, I actually want her not to have that job because it's a worthless job that can't work out. And she's got enough else to worry about. The thing is, if they want to say, okay, you oversee it, but someone else has to be really in charge of it.
Yeah.
One person whose job it is to do his best and do whatever he can to make it better. You can't fix it, but you make it better.
So,
but yeah, she shouldn't have that. That was she did not, he did not consult her before he gave her that job.
No,
so she would have said no.
He was like, yeah, I don't. So just so you know, Billy, the administration.
It's like the thing with the gay thing. Remember how Biden.
Yeah, Billy, hold on a second. The administration released a statement saying that they wanted that Kamala Harris's sole job was to focus on the root causes of immigration. Harris, on the other hand, has dodged questions about actually visiting the border. And this is what's so troubling, is that Biden has come out many, many times and said, oh, yeah, Harris has got it. This is her sole focus. This is all the, you know, the only thing I want her to do. But then she is ill-equipped to actually answer questions about it. So there's something going on with the comms team over at the White House, Billy, that is just so messed up that they're clearly not on the same page when it comes to anything.
I don't know about anything, but yeah, you know, it's, you know, they're not perfect. They're finding their way. They're going to have problems. Yeah, it's like, it's just, oh, it's hard for me to want to get into the pettiness anymore of it all. You know,
you mean like just, the Republicans?
I recognize. Do I think who's being petty? We're all being petty.
No, I mean the Republicans being petty about this. I'm talking about Madison Cawthorn.
Well, Republicans just are petty. You know, the Republicans are petty, nihilistic, and are only interested in power. And the only way for them to have power is to actually steal it.
Okay, Billy, that's a stupid statement. But more importantly, getting back to this story before we get off on your one note of Republican bad, Republican bad, Republican bad, Billy. So the Republicans, which include Madison Cawthorn of North Carolina, Louie Gohmert, one of the smartest men I've ever had the pleasure of listening to, and Jody Heiss.
He is the smartest man in Congress. All the G's.
Yeah.
They
expressed serious concerns regarding Harris's appointment of the administration's leader in solving the crisis. So the letter, by the way, Billy, is it's not exactly inspiring. It is a single paragraph, which just kind of says, after reviewing Senator Harris, blue, blah, blue, blah, blue, blah, blah, we believe blue, blah, 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 blah.
And nothing there.
There's nothing. It's actually kind of embarrassing, Billy. And just to read you a quick segment of it, it says that, dear President Biden, we write to express our serious concerns regarding Vice President appointment as your administration's leader to solve the border crisis. And then they go through all the numbers and going through all the data. And they say, basically, listen, this President Harris and your spokespeople have made excuses about her role in solving the crisis, claiming that her responsibility is to examine the root causes and yet not actually do anything about it. And Billy, but here's the thing, is that they're not wrong about it in this sense, which is that there's nothing that Vice President Harris can actually do to solve the border crisis. There's not a thing on God's green earth that she could possibly do other than to look bad. And she consistently looks very, very bad whenever talking about this issue. She laughs, she giggles, she's avoidant. It's kind of embarrassing, Billy.
Before she was there, they were there. Did they solve the problem?
What do you mean?
The Republicans.
Billy, I don't care about the Republicans. I care about Kamala Harris right now, and I care about the fact that she's doing a bad job and that it's embarrassing.
Who wrote the letter?
What do you mean?
What did they do when they were in control? Nothing.
I don't think so, Billy. I mean, they tried to, well, the wall was an idea.
They solved the problem. You're right. Never mind. Because if they solved the problem, then she wouldn't have a problem to solve. Right?
Well, I think the major problem here, Billy, you're doing the passive aggressive thing where you ask me a question and then I go to answer the question and then you start talking again.
Well, that's because if I wait for you to answer, then you go on for a week and a half.
No, I... Okay, so, Billy, the question was, is that what did they do to stop it?
Nothing.
Well, President Donald Trump went around and he said, don't come to the border because we'll shoo you away, which was technically in violation.
Was that effective?
Billy,
no.
It was more effective. It was much more effective than the Biden administration telling people that they were going to completely revamp the policy and come on up, everybody. Hey, come on down. You want citizenship? We're giving it. He's like Oprah with citizenship, Billy.
You know what it is? It's
what?
The wall. And it's that lovely thing like where, hey, the wall, this is a big scam. We can take 20% off the top like Steve Bannon does. We can just put the money in our pocket.
What are you talking about, Billy?
It's all a scam.
I don't understand.
What I'm saying is that Republicans have no interest in governing. They only have an interest in using government to personally make money and power.
This is a story about the failure of Kamala Harris, and somehow you are turning it into the failure of the Republicans. Kamala Harris has been given a job. She has failed at that job, and now the Republicans are basically trying to throw rocks at Kamala Harris, even though it simply will not work. Nothing that she does will fix the problem. Nothing that they do will fix the problem. And so it's just kind of embarrassing all around. It's not a one note thing. Everybody's at fault here.
Yeah. You know, if you have a job and you do it poorly and then you hand it to someone else.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Then you don't get to complain about what a bad job they do. That's like, that's that thing where the potato explodes, you know, and right before it's going to explode, you hand it to the other guy and go, look the mess you made.
Yeah.
So that's where we find ourselves, you know, just handing it back and forth and complaining to the other guy. You couldn't fix the impossible thing to fix. How come you couldn't fix the Arab-Israeli conflict? Come on.
You know, Billy, that's a really good point. I would say this, that they are kind of playing hot potato with this. But I would like it. I would like it, Billy, if in the last 30 seconds that we have that you could say something nice about me. And then I'll say something nice about you before we have to get out of here.
All right. All right. It was great to see you yesterday. And you know. Obviously, I feel very, very paternalistic towards you,
and
I never wanted to feel that towards anybody.
All right, well, we'll take a really, really quick break, Billy. I guess
You're not supposed to say anything nice about me?
I guess you're all right, Billy. On that note, we actually have to get out of here. We'll be right back with a little bit of Shane Peterson after this. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. What we like to do right here is we like to acknowledge the fact that Shane Peterson is one of the hardest working guys in show business. So we like to go inside of his world where he tells us exactly what he's thinking about, what story is on his mind. Now, what makes this fun, I have no idea what Shane is going to talk about. I've not heard this story. Shane has not run it past me. And so I will be reacting to it in the most natural, normal way possible. Shane Peterson, please.
All right.
Take it away. No, I was waiting for that final little piano. Okay, go ahead, buddy.
All right. Well, Jack, as we know, with everything starting to open up, the world's starting to return to normal, and the Olympics are going to be coming here pretty shortly out here in Japan.
Ah, yes.
Now, there's been some stories that have come out of the news about the Olympics that I wanted to read to you guys. So let me just start off by saying today, for the United States... Yes. Steph Curry has opted out of playing in the Tokyo Olympics for Team USA.
No.
The powerhouse three-point shooter from the Golden State Warriors will be taking a seat and watching his fellow Americans from home and, you know, probably just eating chips or something. I don't know. I don't know why he's choosing not to go to the Olympics.
Why would he do that?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know either. But we're going to take it down a little bit here because... The story that I really wanted to talk about, this one's a little bit more of a juicy story, and this is coming from Fox News. U.S. Olympic athlete Chelsea Wolfe threatened to burn flag on podium. So a BMX freestyle rider named Chelsea Wolfe, who is a transgender female, has qualified as an alternate to represent Team USA in this year's Summer Olympics in Tokyo. And on a tweet that she posted last year, said that her goal was to win an Olympic medal so she could burn the U.S. flag on the podium. Quote, "My goal is to win the Olympics so I can burn the U.S. flag on the podium. This is what they focus on during the pandemic, hurting trans children." Yeah, she posted that on March 25th of 2020 and did that basically in response to a lot of the stuff that Trump was saying about transgender policy. So I saw this story today, and it rubs me the wrong way in a few different ways. Because we've talked about trans issues before here on this show, Jack. And we've also we've also talked a lot about athletes protesting. So both of these two things are nothing that we're not a stranger to talking about. And when I saw this story, I sat and thought about it for a while because it's interesting to think that that would be an avenue for you to protest how you feel about the way that trans people are treated in this country. I don't understand what that would do. I think a better statement would to be to have the rainbow flag with the trans insignia on the inside, the flag that has represents the whole LGBTQ plus community. Why wouldn't you want to take that up there and point that in the faces of everybody else when in reality, a lot of the countries that you might be competing against, they would basically not want you to be alive. And I'm not making excuses, but for me, it's weird because I love people protesting, especially athletes in these powerful positions where they're looked up by so many. But it's still – the burning of the flag thing still really bugs me a lot, just as somebody from having my family's military background. And I'm really conflicted about it because in one sense, I have sympathy for her because she's obviously a very angry person. She has a lot of stuff that has made her upset, and she feels excluded from society and feels that other people are more excluded than her, and she wants to make a statement. But I don't think that burning or doing anything that is really going to, you know, make any good changes or really be like, hey, take that, fascist. It's a hard thing for me to wrap my head around. And I mean, I was curious if you saw the story and maybe what your opinion was about it.
Shane, let me give you a little bit of insight into this kind of thinking. What they call it is militant queerness, or they call it kind of militarized queerness, which is this idea that it's in your face activism, in your face queerness. And the idea is that queer people have been marginalized, or that trans people have been marginalized for so very long, and they've been told to be quiet and to be, pushed aside and to be very reserved. And that they are taking a much more hardline approach by saying, no, we will get in your face and we will we'll burn your flag because we simply don't care. And understand this as well, though, Shane. It's not about the symbolic burning of the flag for this individual. It's about that militarized queerness or that militarized transness. It's to get people to talk about it. So by tweeting something out like that, yeah, it's for kind of clout. It's for, fun internet points. But it's also to demonstrate to all of that individual's buddies that they're militarized in that way. Does that make sense? That they're willing to take it to the edge, man. That I'm going to get up on that podium and I'm going to stick it to these people. And I'm going to say, listen, I'm a trans woman and you're not going to silence me. So I'm going to take the American flag and I'm going to burn it. And then after I burn it, you know what I'm going to do, Shane? I'm going to take out another American flag and I'm going to burn that one as well. And then as soon as I'm done with that one, I'm going to take out two of them and I'm going to strap them both to fireworks and light those fireworks and send them off into the sky so when they explode, it shows the LGBTQA flag. And then everyone around me will say, yeah, you go, girl. And I'll say, yeah, because I'm a militarized queer woman. See, Shane, that's the idea.
Yeah. Reading the story, it's hard for me to wrap my head around it, man. I'm just sitting back and listening. I've never heard anybody use the word queer and militarized in the same sentence before, so I'm intrigued.
Militarized queerness. Shane, we actually have to get out of here, but I appreciate you wrapping your mind around it. When we get back, Stacey Jo Ross is going to come in, and Shane, we're going to be talking about that athlete, that football player, who has said that he would rather quit than have to get the COVID-19 vaccine.
Yeah, Cole Beasley, I know him.
So we'll take a really quick break. We'll be right back after this.